from KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. It makes sense that erratic work schedules, which are common for employees in low-wage fast food and retail jobs, are stressful. And now we have some data to help us understand the psychological toll it really takes. Professors from UC Berkeley and UC San Francisco have spent the last few years talking to some 80,000 workers and found that unpredictable work shifts are tied to poor sleep and unhappiness and may even cause more distress than low wages. Joining me now are the study authors. Danny Schneider is assistant professor in the Department of Sociology at UC Berkeley. Hello, Danny Schneider.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being here. We also have Kristen Harknett on. She's Associate Professor of Social Behavioral Sciences at UCSF's School of Nursing. Good morning, Kristen Harknett.
Good morning.
So one of the more surprising things you say to emerge from your data are that having control over time and schedules may have a more significant impact on basically worker and family well-being than wages. How so?
Yes, so this was one of the really striking findings when we set out to understand work schedules and how they impact workers' lives. We expected that they'd have a big impact. What we weren't necessarily expecting was how much larger of an effect time has than money. And it's not to say that wages aren't important, because of course, how much you earn per hour is important. But when you're paid by the hour, the number of hours you get and the timing of when you have to work makes a really big difference for your ability to plan your life, for how much you're going to earn, for who's going to watch your kids and when. So there are a whole host of spillover consequences when schedules are unstable.
So tell me a little bit, Danny Schneider, about this experiment. I mentioned that you, or study basically, you talked with some 80,000 workers. What were some of the key questions you were seeking to answer? Who were some of the participants in this study?
Great. You know, we really began this study because these felt like important questions around not just how much people earn, but when they work and how much control they have over work. And what we just found was that the data to answer those kinds of questions didn't exist. And that's why we really started our study. We've been surveying workers, as you say, about 80,000 of them over the last 3 years. And these are frontline hourly workers who are employed at the nation's largest fast food and retail chains. These are the kinds of stores that we see downtown or at around the country we would see in shopping malls. And they are really large employers in these sectors that seem to engage not just in having low pay for their workers, but also having really erratic and unstable schedules. And what we wanted to do was to ask these workers about exactly what their schedules look like. So that means not just knowing how much they're paid an hour, but asking folks, how much advance notice do you get of your work schedule? That is, how many days in advance do you know when you'll work? We also wanted to know from workers how variable their schedules were. Do you have the same shift every week, or does it move around? We wanted to know how many hours people get every week. Do you have a steady number of hours, or is it volatile? Is it erratic with different number of hours from week to week? We also didn't want to stop there because we wanted to understand how these schedules matter for workers and their families' well-being. So part of the innovation here is to ask both about the quality of work, particularly with regard to time, but also about how people are doing, their economic security and their mental health.
So what were the findings, Kristen Harknett? I mean, how much notice did people typically get about schedule changes? How did that affect the way that they were able to handle their schedules? How consistent were these schedules from 1 week to the next?
So we started off, before we surveyed these 80,000-some workers, we just spoke to workers face-to-face. And what we heard again and again was, my hours go up and down, and so does my pay. I don't know if I'm going to be working 40 hours this week or 20 hours this week. And then when we went and we measured this at a large scale in our survey, we found that only about a third of workers have 2 weeks advance notice of their schedule. About a third of workers have less than 1 week's advance notice of when they're going to work and how much they're going to work. And some workers have even less notice. They know just 1 or 2 days in advance. We also saw that once schedules are set, they're subject to change. So about a quarter of workers have an on-call schedule where they just call in the day before.
Is this a growth? I mean, are more employers moving to this kind of scheduling?
Kristen Harknett?
Well, we haven't had good data over time to track how this has changed. But we do know that with technology and scheduling algorithms, employers have been able to engage in what's called just-in-time scheduling, where they're trying to very closely align their staffing with consumer demand. That means that they're making these last-minute adjustments that might be good from the narrow perspective of labor costs for the employer, but they exact a human toll, as we show in our research. They're very, very bad for workers' ability to plan, ability to sleep.
Is it just the bottom line issues, Danny Schneider, that make this appealing to employers?
Yeah, I think, you know, we can think about these labor practices around time in a broader context. And that's a broader context that's very much part of the national conversation, that we've seen job quality degrade over the past 50 years in lots of ways, right? We often actually talk about it in terms of pay, how the minimum wage at the federal level has been stagnant, how employer-provided benefits have eroded, particularly for low-income workers. And here we see another aspect of that kind of loss of job quality. And I do think that a good way to understand this is through the prism of employers really shifting models from one where decades ago, there was a model of investing in your employees and sort of taking care of them as a good business practice, to one where there's really a focus on short-term profit maximization. And just as paying workers relatively little can help you do that in the short term, so can this kind of just-in-time scheduling, where you don't pay for an hour that you don't absolutely need. It is a profit-based perspective. It's a very short-term-based perspective on the employer side.
I can hear employers, though, saying, well, but with the high cost of doing business, we need these kinds of savings in labor. I mean, especially here in the Bay Area, as we know, it costs a lot to be able to have any kind of property. So is that a legitimate argument?
You know,
Kristen Harknett.
One thing we see in our data, we've surveyed 80,000 workers, and those workers work at around 100 large retail and food service employers. And we can look and we can see that although these practices are prevalent overall of offering short notice or on call or canceling at the last minute, there is a lot of variation where some employers are making the choice to give workers more notice or have more stability once the schedule is set. So there certainly is an element of choice.
We're talking about the psychological and economic toll that shift work, erratic schedules, can have on employees. Are you an on-call employee, or do you otherwise have an uncertain work schedule? Tell us about your experiences. Are you an employer? Do you use just-in-time scheduling? Give us a call at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also reach us on Twitter, Facebook, on our website, or email us at forum@kqed.org. Now, San Francisco has passed a law, I believe it was back in 2014 or 2015, where it did regulate the amount of time, the amount of notice, basically whether, you know, how you had to pay if you canceled. Can you give us some of the changes that San Francisco has implemented, Kristen Harknett, and whether or not they're effective?
Sure. So the San Francisco law, which gets referred to as the Retail Workers Bill of Rights, does a few things. It requires large employers to offer 2 weeks advance notice and requires a little bit of extra pay when schedules are set with less advance notice than that or changed with less advance notice. There's also a really important provision called access to hours, because so many of these retail and food service workers are not getting enough hours scheduled to make ends meet. And employers hire new part-time workers before offering their existing part-time workers more hours. So the San Francisco law and other laws like it in Seattle and New York City, Oregon State, have said, you know, workers should offer their existing part-timers the option to boost their schedule to closer to full-time or to full-time before they go out and hire more part-time workers.
Danny Schneider, do you think San Francisco's model is one for other cities? There has been some pushback saying that there have been some unintended consequences. For example, if workers want to have more hours, they're not able to have hours added within short notice because it would mean more cost to the employer, for example.
So San Francisco really paved the way with the Retail Workers Bill of Rights, and it is a model that is beginning to be adopted in other cities and states around the country, as Kristen mentioned. Seattle passed a secure scheduling ordinance. New York City has passed ordinances that regulate schedules for fast food and retail workers. The state of Oregon has passed a law, the city of Philadelphia. I think these laws are really carefully crafted. And one thing I've been impressed with is the degree to which the city agencies responsible for implementing and enforcing these laws have engaged in collaborative rulemaking with all interested parties, with employers and business groups, with workers, and with advocates. And I think what you see there is really an effort to make sure that the scenario you describe isn't one that happens, that what these laws are trying to regulate is really the involuntary instability that these practices can represent. And it's really not trying to close off any degree of flexibility that these workers have. But what I'll say is that flexibility, desirable flexibility, the way that I, as a university professor, have it, is vanishingly rare in these sectors. 80% of the workers we survey say they don't have any or don't have any substantial control over their schedules. 70% say they have to keep their schedules open and available. So the idea that these regulations are somehow removing flexibility, I really don't think holds water.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what you mean by psychological stress now. We understand that it's having this sort of distressing result, but how does that play out? I know sleep has been something that you've looked at, Kristen Harknett. So describe how it affects sleep, but other things that it does to people in terms of psychological states.
Sure. I earlier this week heard from a Rite Aid worker who was testifying to the Los Angeles City Council. And she was saying the night before, she'd been working at Rite Aid for 30 years. The night before, she had to work till 1 a.m. And then she got up and she came and she testified to City Council. And she said, over 30 years, I have never gotten used to the fact that I might have to work till 1 a.m. I might have to start working at 5 a.m. in the morning. So we hear that from workers' stories again and again. In our data, we see that we can make comparisons between workers who get the same types of low wages and work the same types of jobs, but we can make a distinction between those who have very unstable schedules, they just don't have any advance notice, they change all the time, versus those workers who are lucky and have very, very stable schedules. And what we see with sleep and with psychological distress is that there is a vast gulf between those two types of schedules. So to give you an example, we see that about 13% of workers with highly unstable schedules report having good quality sleep. If you stabilize the schedules, triple the proportion of workers say that they have good sleep. It's a really huge difference. And we see a similar gulf between least and most stable schedules for psychological distress. It basically triples the reports of being depressed and nervous and feeling hopeless.
Well, let's go to our listeners. Arlinda in Oakland is on. Hi, Arlinda.
Hi. I'm a registered nurse, now retired. And I went on call in order to control my schedule, on call without benefits, because it's important in nursing to be able to be rested and be able to give good patient care. Because you make a mistake, that can have negative ramifications. So, you know, I would have to give up my weekend. First, I had to work in a specialty area, which is high demand, give up my weekend, work PMs, and pull a double on Sunday night so that I could then make enough money to give myself adequate rest time between. So I always was on top of my game when I came in and able to give good patient care. Whereas a friend of mine who was allowing herself to be staffed was making mistakes at work, and the nurses were covering up for each other. So I think it's really important for good patient care that nurses have some control over their schedule so they can be adequately rested and come in and give good care.
Kristen Harknett.
I really appreciate you sharing that story. Danny and I have been focused on retail and food service, but certainly these issues about unstable schedules are much broader and much wider. And your example of the healthcare setting is so important. And I think it really speaks to what Danny alluded to before, where when employers are using just-in-time scheduling, there's a very short-sighted perspective there. And a cost of it is that workers are going to make more mistakes. If workers are exhausted exhausted and they're distressed, then they're not going to be able to perform at as high a level. And in a healthcare setting, that's hugely consequential, but it's also consequential in retail and food service to an employer's bottom line.
Well, Louise says, I worked for the airlines for 25 years, and I can tell you erratic schedules have a devastating effect on one's well-being, not just from the so-called temporary jet lag, but the long-term effects on the body, like diabetes, weight gain, permanent sleep disruption, etc. Knowing what I know now, I would avoid at all costs any work that involves shift work. Our health is not worth it. This listener writes, who is most likely to be an on-call worker? Women, people of color? Does it demographically tend to be pretty consistent? Danny Schneider?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think in part because sometimes we have a vision of retail or fast food workers as being, you know, kids or teenagers, people making a little money on the side, a first career step, a first rung, a first entry into the job market. And I think, you know, not just in our data, but what the official statistics make really clear is that that's not the case. A large share of workers in the retail and food service sector are in their late 20s, 30s, or even older. And that many of these workers are parents. They are not just, you know, sort of kids starting out. In fact, we estimate that 1 in 10 American children has a parent who works in the retail or food service sectors. So, you know, this is really a set of practices that touches a broad cross-section of society.
What is the effect on the children? Have you studied that?
Yeah, I think that's a really important question, and it's important because we should care about the effects on workers. But if these schedules also have effects on kids, that's a story about intergenerational consequences, right? That's a story about how these labor practices today may restrain the mobility of children in the future. One thing we've looked at on this is how unstable and unpredictable work schedules that parents may be exposed to may shape the care that children have. So if parents have patchworks of work schedules, do children then have patchworks of care schedules? And so in some work that we've done with grad students here at UC Berkeley, we really show how that instability is really transferred between generations, that when parents have unstable and unpredictable schedules, they have to scramble for childcare. And where children thrive on consistency and regularity of care and routines, these schedules really make that impossible. The kids whose parents have these schedules have much more, many different kinds of care providers in order to sort of cover at the last minute. They're much more likely to have informal care. And we know that those things are really important for affecting children's healthy development and ultimately their attainment.
Well, this listener writes, this is so obvious. Did you really need to study it? Why is it important to have academic research on this? To some extent, are you kind of adjusting the focus on the minimum wage, for example? We've really focused quite a bit on the need for a $15 federal minimum wage. Are you saying that, you know, really we need to maybe shift our policy focus to hours? Kristen Harknett?
That's a great question. And I think for anybody who's worked in these sectors and experienced this instability firsthand, it is a no-brainer that there are going to be some harmful consequences of it. We set out to provide systematic information because not everybody knows just how prevalent and how impactful this is. And so there are some really striking findings, even though some of them feel like no surprise, the fact that time and schedules seem to matter so much more than even wages that we already knew were so important was surprising.
So do you think this needs to be part of the call for a minimum wage, meaning minimum wage plus hours, plus consistent or stable hours?
Absolutely. And I think what we've seen across the country is that cities that have fought for a living wage will then follow those campaigns with Fair Work Week campaigns, because it doesn't do you any good to be making $15 an hour if you're only getting scheduled for 20 hours a week and you need 40.
Well, let's go next to Bill in Mountain View. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Good morning. Great conversation. My comment and then question is, I run a nonprofit scientific research institution, and I've spent most of my career in, you know, Silicon Valley high tech, where gender diversity and diversity broadly is struggling. And I noticed that our institute, you know, we are almost a poster child for at least gender diversity in science and technology. I asked one of our women scientists, who is also a mother of five, how she does this and how this kind of career has enabled her to be successful. And her answer was that at least in the kind of work we're doing and she's doing, she has complete control of her schedule because her deliverables are sort of task-based and goal-based, and she can, you know, work when she's able to and build her own life schedule around that with complete flexibility. There's no, you know, time clock. And I thought that was very telling and wondered how Silicon Valley and other industries might be able to build into more task-oriented jobs, at least, the kind of schedule flexibility that seems to enable us to be successful in this area. It's clearly a struggle if you're talking about retail sectors or other sort of hourly-based, time-scheduled places. But anyway, it's kind of a lessons learned, and wonder if your guests can comment on how that kind of flexibility might play into other employment sectors.
Bill, thanks. Danny Schneider, Kristen Harknett, any responses to Bill?
So I would just first use Bill's example to sort of turn around and illustrate, you know, given what his employee scientist said, just how difficult we can imagine it would be then to not have any of that control and be confronted with this instability and insecurity of work hours. So not only can you not control when you work, but your employer is constantly changing when you work. And so it's, in some sense, it's the opposite end of that spectrum where some white collar workers, and it is not really that widespread, have both control and flexibility. These are workers who lack control and have instability. And so you can imagine the challenge for parents, and many of these workers are parents, are immense. And so I do think that really focuses in some sense on the challenge that these workers face.
Well, Gloria writes, my husband and I own a small retail business in San Francisco. We employ five part-time workers, all college students. We're barely making a profit as it is, and there's no financial way we could pay the benefits concurrent with a full-time appointment. With great difficulty, we follow the retail clerk's rules imposed by the city and often have considered closing our business because the trouble is not worth it. Kristen Harknett, you're nodding.
Yeah, so it's important to recognize that the law in San Francisco, as in other places, doesn't apply to the small, locally owned businesses. They do not have to follow these rules. These rules were really rolled out for large employers who have the capacity to make these changes and offer more predictability. And they are already using algorithms. These larger companies are already using algorithms to do their scheduling. And technology, in a way, has been part of the problem in creating these extremely erratic schedules. But technology can also be part of the solution for these larger employers. They can use automated shift swapping technology. They can have scheduling algorithms that take into account when workers absolutely just can't be available.
Well, Nurley in San Francisco joined the conversation. Hi, Nurley, are you there? Oh, I think we'll try to see if we can get Nurley back on the line. Matt writes, I just got a 3-day-a-week part-time job. The first day they asked if I could work full-time. The schedule is set 1 day in advance, and I've already had to come in on my day off. It's still my first week. Any advice for Matt in terms of how to create a more sustainable schedule? I don't know what the size of this employer might be, but any thoughts for him?
I mean, for Matt to recognize is that he's not alone in this, and that, you know, millions of workers contend with this kind of schedule unpredictability and instability. I think many workers worry that by speaking up to their managers and asking for more stability, they may experience retaliation or may suffer negative consequences. And one thing that ordinances like secure scheduling ordinance do is they at least put in the law that kind of retaliation is illegal. And I do think that the law is powerful for sort of ideally giving workers a little more voice and a little more power to speak up to their employers and try to assert their rights and their preferences.
Angelica in Mountain View, you're on.
Hi. So First of all, thank you to these researchers for finally taking the time to research this. I think this has been a really underserved area. So I wanted to talk a little bit about my experience as a when I was about 18, 19, working for big retail. And basically that experience driving me towards realizing that agency in my schedule was probably the biggest thing that was going to determine my quality of life. So I worked for big retail, and I think anyone who has done that is familiar with clopening or having to both close and open the next morning. Mm-hmm. So when I was working, they really didn't take into account the fact that I had to take public transportation in determining my schedule, which really limited my options, especially for women who have to take public transportation and are forced to work late at night or early in the morning. I've known many women who have been harassed. I personally was stalked on the way home and had someone who was following me on the way home. The person who was determining my schedule really didn't care, would schedule me to close until 1 in the morning and open again at 8 in the morning. And it wasn't until my stalker came into the store that they actually did something and realized that it was a problem.
Well, Angelica, I'm so sorry to hear that, and I'm sorry we're running out of time, but I do want to ask our researchers to respond to your point about clopening. Am I correct that in your research you found that half of your respondents had worked a clopening?
Yes. And that was one of the surprising and striking findings, was just how common it is for workers like Angelica to have to close and then open. And if I can quickly make a point, Matt and Angelica's stories really make clear that this isn't a problem that individual workers should be expected to solve on their own. Their stories really make clear that we need policy. We individuals shouldn't have to negotiate for a safe schedule or a fair schedule. Employers and policymakers need to set some limits and some rules around this so workers don't have to do it on their own.
Well, I'll end with Jenny's tweet. Your guest said maybe we need to focus on hours. I'd argue that we need to shift our focus to people. People need good, well-paying jobs with regular schedules, period. Our policy should have the economy serving us, not people serving the economy. Well, Kristen Harknett, Associate Professor of Social Behavioral Sciences at UCSF School of Nursing, and Danny Schneider, Assistant Professor in the Department of Sociology at UC Berkeley. Thanks for coming on and sharing your research with us today.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
And thanks to our listeners for sharing their stories and for their questions and comments. I'm Mina Kim. You've been listening to Forum. Have a great weekend.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.